Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Hello, comrades and friends. Welcome to Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU. This is Siegfried, and tonight I want to discuss the state of siege that has been imposed on the Cuban people since their heroic revolution triumphed in 1959, and which has been redoubled by the Trump administration in recent weeks. The US empire cannot tolerate a strong, independent, socialist state in the Western Hemisphere, in its proverbial backyard. A state which is sovereign, controls its own resources, economy, and industry for the benefit of its own citizens. It can't tolerate that, and so it tries to starve this tiny island nation of 11 million people, trying to turn Cuba's courageous example of independent development and international solidarity into a nightmare of misery and suffering and fuel shortages and everything, you know, leading ultimately to renewed colonization and submission to the empire and its dictates, you know, and the capture of its economy by American corporations and the exploitation of its people. That's what America wants. That's what America had before the Cuban Revolution of 1959. America controlled everything in Cuba before 1959. You know, that's what Trump wants. He wants to get back to that. He's very open about it. That's what the entire American elite is very open about. That's what the entire American capitalist class is all about. And America's weaknesses, you know, they're increasingly being exposed throughout the world. The limitations of America's power are on full display. You know, economically, militarily, a lot of different ways, right? America just is not as strong as it used to be. And also the corruption and venality of America's leaders is on full display with the Epstein files. So the weakening empire has to show strength through naked displays of force and violence, like it did in Venezuela last month, in a raid that killed 32 Cubans, along with over 100 Venezuelans, and kidnapped a sitting lawfully elected president. Now the U.S. is sending three aircraft carrier strike groups towards Iran, even as it purports to engage in diplomacy. And at the same time, it's trying to starve Cuba and cut it off from its trade partners and just from the world in general. And unfortunately, it seems like Canada is playing along with this. But Cuba's no pushover. It's withstood over 60 years of economic siege. And the country, you know, small as it is, and its people, 11 million of them, have demonstrated their resilience time and again. This isn't their first rodeo, to put it mildly. So I want to read Manolo de los Santos's excellent article from People's Dispatch entitled, "For the Cuban People, Surrender is Not an Option." And I want to read that right now. It starts by saying, "Claims by officials in Washington that Cuba's collapse is imminent usually coincide with a tightening of the blockade. Yet once again, Cubans have reaffirmed their commitment to the revolution and their creative resistance in the face of the latest U.S. attacks." And it begins, "The halls of power in Washington are echoing with a familiar predatory chorus. Once again, the White House, various think tank experts, and U.S. politicians are predicting the imminent collapse of Cuba. This is a tune the world has heard for over 60 years, usually sung at its highest volume whenever the United States decides to tighten the economic noose around the island's neck. However, in 2026, the rhetoric has shifted from sanctions to an overt campaign of total strangulation. Under a new executive order signed in late January, the second Trump administration has escalated the decades-long blockade into a proactive fuel blockade. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel laid bare the intended consequences in a press conference on February 5th, 2026. Quote, not allowing a single drop of fuel to enter our country will affect transportation, food production, tourism, children's education, and the healthcare system. End quote. The objective is clear: to induce systemic failure, sow popular discontent, and create conditions for political destabilization. The White House rhetoric confirms this intent. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt's statement on the same day that, quote, the Cuban government is on its last leg and its country is about to collapse, end quote, is not an analysis but public signaling, a psychological operation meant to reinforce the narrative of inevitable doom and pressure Cuban leadership into unilateral concessions. This policy is not merely a sanction in the traditional sense. It is a calculated attempt to suffocate a nation by blocking every drop of fuel from reaching its shores. The administration has authorized aggressive tariffs and sanctions on any foreign country or company that dares to trade oil with the island, effectively treating Cuban territorial waters as a zone of exclusion. Since December, multiple oil tankers headed to Cuba have been seized by U.S. naval forces in the Caribbean or forced to return to their ports of origin under threat of asset forfeiture. In direct response to this intensifying siege, Cuba has announced sweeping fuel rationing measures designed to protect essential services. The plan prioritizes fuel for healthcare, water, food production, education, public transportation, and defense, while strictly limiting sales to private drivers. To secure vital foreign currency, the tourism sector and key export industries such as cigar production will continue operating. Schools will maintain full in-person primary education with hybrid systems implemented for higher levels. The leadership of the Cuban Revolution has affirmed that Cuba will not collapse. To the planners in the White House, Cuba is a 67-year-old problem to be solved with starvation and darkness. But to the Cuban people, the current crisis is a continuation of a long-standing refusal to trade their sovereignty for Washington's demands of submission. To understand why the Cuban people have not descended into the chaos Washington predicted, one must look to the historical precedent of the special period in time of peace. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Cuba experienced an economic shock that would have toppled almost any other modern state. Overnight, the island lost 85% of its international trade and nearly all of its subsidized fuel imports. The resulting statistics were staggering. The gross domestic product plummeted by 35%, and the daily caloric intake of the average citizen dropped from over 3,000 calories to roughly 1,800. During this era, the lights went out across the island for more than 16 hours a day, and the bicycle became the primary mode of transportation as the public transit system collapsed. At the same time, Washington escalated its assault through the Torricelli Act of 1992 and the Helms-Burton Law of 1996, each tightening the noose around Cuba's economy. However, instead of fracturing under the weight of this tightening blockade, Cubans developed Option Zero, a survival plan designed to keep hospitals running and children fed without any fuel, and the Cuban social fabric tightened. The government prioritized the distribution of the remaining resources to the most vulnerable, ensuring that infant mortality rates remain lower than those of many parts of the United States, despite the scarcity. This period proved that when a population is politically conscious of the external forces causing their suffering, they become extraordinarily resilient. The special period was not just a time of hunger. It was a period of forced innovation that gave rise to the world's first national experiment in organic urban farming and mass-scale energy conservation. The crisis of 2026 is in many ways a sequel to the 1990s, but with higher stakes and more advanced technological targets. The roots of the current energy shortage can be traced back to the first Trump administration's decision in 2019 to target Cuban oil imports as a means of punishing the island for its solidarity with Venezuela. By designating Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism and activating Title III of the Helms-Burton Act, the U.S. successfully scared off international shipping lines and insurance companies. This was followed by a focused campaign against the PDVSA, Venezuela's state oil company, and the shipping firms involved in the trade agreement between countries in the region known as ALBA TCP. By 2025, the impact on Cuba's energy grid was catastrophic. The island's thermal power plants, most of which were built with aging Soviet technology, were never designed to burn the heavy sulfur-rich crude that Cuba produces domestically without constant maintenance and expensive imported additives. The lack of foreign exchange caused by the tightening of the blockade meant that spare parts were non-existent. By the time the 2026 fuel blockade began, the national grid was already operating at 25% below its required capacity. President Miguel Diaz-Canel has begun has been transparent. He's been transparent with the public, noting that without fuel, everything from the morning school bus to the refrigeration systems for the nation's advanced biotech medicines is under constant threat. A reality that has now precipitated the stringent new rationing regime. The current U.S. stance towards Cuba cannot be viewed in isolation from its recent military interventions in the Middle East and Latin America. The regime change efforts in Cuba are being modeled after the maximum pressure campaigns used against Iran and the military incursions seen in Venezuela on January 3, 2026. The threat of a U.S. military attack is no longer a rhetorical flourish used by Havana to drum up nationalism. It is a documented strategic option discussed in Washington. The logic behind such an intervention is twofold. First, there is the ideological drive to eliminate the contagion of a country that questions the Monroe Doctrine and U.S. domination in the region. Cuba's existence serves as a reminder that sovereignty is possible, even in the shadow of a superpower. Second, and more pragmatically, the U.S. is motivated by a thirst for strategic minerals. Cuba sits on some of the world's largest reserves of nickel and cobalt, essential components in lithium-ion batteries that power the global transition to electric vehicles and advanced weaponry. In a world where the U.S. is scrambling to compete with China for control of the mineral and energy supply chain, a sovereign Cuba that controls its own mines is seen as an obstacle to American hegemony. If the U.S. can force a collapse, these minerals would no longer belong to the Cuban people. They would be auctioned off to U.S. corporations as it was before 1959. However, the Cuban response to this renewed strangulation is not a white flag of surrender. Recognizing that fossil fuel dependence is a vulnerability that the U.S. will always exploit, Cuba has, in recent years, launched an extraordinary national effort to transform its energy matrix. Building on this momentum, the country completed 49 new solar parks in 2025 alone. This massive undertaking added approximately 1,000 megawatts of power to the national grid, marking a 7% increase in total grid capacity and accounting for a remarkable 38% of the nation's energy generation. By the end of March 2026, with support from China, the island is on track to add over 150 megawatts of renewable power to its grid through the rapid deployment of solar parks. The strategy is clear. If the empire can shut off the oil, Cuba will harvest the sun. Quote, the way the U.S. energy blockade has been implemented reinforces our commitment to the renewable energy strategy, end quote, President Miguel Diaz-Canel declared. The government has committed to a plan to generate 24% of the country's electricity from renewable sources by 2030, with a long-term goal of achieving total energy independence. This involves not just large-scale solar farms, but the decentralization of the grid through the installation of thousands of small-scale solar panels on homes and state buildings. This energy sovereignty movement is the 21st century equivalent to the 1990s urban gardens. It is a way of overcoming the U.S. blockade by removing the very commodity, oil, that Washington uses as a leash. The narrative of Cuba's imminent collapse has been written 1,000 times by people who do not understand the depth of the island's historical memory. The 2026 fuel blockade is a brutal crime against a civilian population designed to create the very chaos that the U.S. media then reports as proof of government failure. It is the arsonist blaming the house for being flammable. The newly imposed fuel rationing is not a sign of surrender, but a tactical maneuver of national defense. A structured effort to outlast the assault while safeguarding the pillars of Cuban society that precisely make it an alternative to the U.S. model. Yet Cuba's message to the world remains consistent. They are willing to talk and trade, but not to be owned or become a neo-colony of the United States. The story of Cuba is not one of a failed state, but of a people who have decided that the most potent fuel for their future isn't oil. It's the will to remain independent. As the sun rises over the new solar arrays in the Cuban countryside, it serves as a silent, glowing testament to a nation that refuses to disappear. So that was Manolo de los Santos from People's Dispatch with the article, "For the Cuban People, Surrender is Not an Option." So we see this heroic resilience in the face of this brutal blockade, which is intended to impose tremendous costs upon the civilian population. It's intended to starve the civilian population of Cuba. And once again, he's amazing at this. Ben Norton recently did a brilliant breakdown of just the brutal dynamics of this blockade on Cuba in a recent episode of Political Economy Report. So I'm going to play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The U.S. government is using hunger as a weapon, starving millions of civilians. The Donald Trump administration has imposed a medieval-style siege against the tiny island nation of Cuba, and even the Wall Street Journal, which is very anti-Cuba, acknowledged that life in Cuba is grinding to a halt under this extreme oil blockade that the U.S. has imposed. Now, the blockade against Cuba is not new. This goes back more than 60 years. But Trump has taken it to a whole new level and prevented Cuba from getting access to any oil to try to collapse the economy. This means that Cuba has been forced to shut down schools and government offices and public transportation, and international flights have been canceled. And Western media outlets are asking, how long before Cuba collapses? This is the goal of the U.S. government. It is medieval-style siege warfare to collapse the entire country. And when I say the U.S. government is using hunger as a weapon, I'm not in any way exaggerating. This was openly admitted by a U.S. Congress member, Representative Maria Elvira Salazar from Miami, Florida. She is a far-right Republican and a close ally of Donald Trump. And on Twitter, Salazar has been openly calling to starve women and children in Cuba. Again, I'm not in any way exaggerating. This is one of her tweets, translated from Spanish. She only posted it in Spanish. But she said, the U.S. must deny oxygen to Cuba, to deny every dollar, every trip, to stop everything. No more tourism, no more remittances. And then she added, quote, it's devastating to think about a mother's hunger, about a child who needs immediate help, end quote. She is admitting, without hiding it at all, that the goal of the U.S. empire is literally to starve women and children to bring about total collapse of Cuba's economy and society in order to overthrow Cuba's revolutionary government. It's not just the government that is suffering from this criminal blockade that the U.S. has imposed on Cuba. There are 11 million Cubans in the country, and they're all suffering. This is extreme collective punishment. The peace activist and journalist Medea Benjamin has been in Cuba and writing about her experience. She's been interviewing people in Cuba. She interviewed a mother who's a hairdresser in Cuba's city of Holguín, who said the following through tears, quote, you can't imagine how it touches every part of our lives. It's a vicious, all-encompassing spiral downward. With no gasoline, buses don't run so we can't get to work. We have electricity only 3 to 6 hours a day. There's no gas for cooking, so we're burning wood and charcoal in our apartments. It's like going back 100 years. The blockade is suffocating us, especially single mothers, and no one is stopping these demons, Trump and Marco Rubio, end quote. That is a Cuban mother crying about the horrible crime against humanity that the U.S. empire is carrying out. The U.S. is the most powerful country on earth, and it is doing everything it can to try to crush a small island nation of 11 million people, to send the lives of the people of Cuba back 100 years, to starve them, to try to destroy their country. This is absolutely barbaric and monstrous. And U.S. government officials are gloating about the fact that they are terrorizing the people of Cuba, especially these far-right Congress members from Miami, Florida, who are Trump allies, like Maria Elvira Salazar. They're openly saying, do not travel to Cuba. They want to crush the country. They're boasting that there is no electricity, no food, no medicine, only blackouts and hunger. Not mentioning that that's the intentional goal. They're intentionally causing blackouts and shortages and hunger. And they claim that the regime is in its final hours. They're literally starving as many people as possible to try to overthrow the government. Here I'm looking at a tweet from a Cuban journalist who lives inside Cuba, and he's been talking about how the U.S. blockade has totally paralyzed the education system. He noted that ever since the revolution in 1959, education has been public, free, and universal up to and including the university level. But now Trump's total blockade has paralyzed universities. Literally, the U.S. is taking away the right to study from children and young people in Cuba, directly harming the people. And this is deeply ironic because the U.S. constantly claims to be the richest country on earth, and yet universities are not free in the U.S. They're insanely expensive. There are young people who spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and then go into debt for decades to try to get education in the U.S. So now that the U.S. doesn't provide higher education for free to its people, it's also denying education to the people of Cuba. And it goes without saying that this U.S. blockade of Cuba is obviously completely illegal according to international law. And United Nations human rights experts have publicly condemned this outrageous medieval siege. UN human rights experts emphasized that the U.S. fuel blockade on Cuba is, quote, a serious violation of international law, end quote. And Trump's defenders have been saying, fine, if Cuba can't trade with the U.S., why don't they trade with other countries? Well, because the U.S. government, Trump himself, is openly threatening to impose tariffs and sanctions on other countries and foreign companies that sell oil to Cuba. This is not just about Cuba. The U.S. is threatening all countries and all foreign companies on earth to try to prevent everyone from doing business with Cuba and selling Cuba oil to starve the entire country. And these UN human rights experts emphasized that, quote, there is no right under international law to impose economic penalties on third states for engaging in lawful trade with another sovereign country, end quote. The U.S., again, is a total rogue state, blatantly spitting in the face of international law, clearly violating the sacred principles of sovereign equality, non-intervention, and self-determination, which are very clearly written in the UN Charter. These UN human rights experts warned that the illegal U.S. blockade of Cuba, quote, could lead to a severe humanitarian crisis, end quote. And this is an example of, quote, the collective punishment of civilians, end quote. UN human rights experts demand that the U.S. immediately lift its blockade, but there will be no consequences for the U.S. rogue regime because the U.S. has veto power in the UN Security Council, so Washington doesn't care about international law, and it certainly doesn't care about human rights and sovereignty. And to be clear, I should stress that obviously this policy did not start under Donald Trump. The U.S. empire has been desperately trying to overthrow the Cuban government ever since the revolution in 1959. In 1961, the CIA organized a failed invasion known as Bay of Pigs. And back in 1960, just 1 year after the revolution, some U.S. State Department officials admitted what their strategy was. In a declassified cable, they acknowledged that the majority of Cubans supported the revolutionary leader Fidel Castro, and therefore the U.S. empire concluded that, quote, the only foreseeable means of alienating internal support is through disenchantment and disaffection based on economic dissatisfaction and hardship, end quote. Then they went on explaining what the intention of the illegal U.S. sanctions and embargo against Cuba was. The intention was, quote, every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba, end quote. That has been their goal for more than 60 years, weaken the economic life of Cuba. And they went on writing that their goal is to, quote, make the greatest inroads in denying money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government, end quote. That has been the explicitly stated policy of the U.S. empire for more than 60 years. And this is exactly what the Trump administration is doing today. Of course, this is not a new policy, but the Trump administration has taken it to a whole new level, imposing a fuel blockade of Cuba to try to crush the entire country and starve 11 million people. In fact, corporate media outlets in the U.S. that are owned by billionaire oligarchs, like the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, one of the richest billionaire oligarchs on earth, the founder of Amazon, they are openly boasting that, quote, Cuba is collapsing. That's an opportunity for Trump, end quote. They are proud of the fact that they are barbaric medieval savages who are starving 11 million people to try to overthrow their government. The U.S. government wants the Cuban people to suffer. That is literally the goal. They're not hiding it in any way. The U.S. State Department posted on its official Facebook profile a video of Secretary of State Marco Rubio being asked in Congress about regime change, and he said, we would love to see regime change in Cuba. They are proud of it.
Will you make a public commitment today to rule out U.S. regime change in Cuba?
Regime change?
Yes.
Oh, no, I think we would love to see the regime there change. We would like to, that doesn't mean that we're going to make a change, but we would love to see it change. There's no doubt about the fact that it would be of great benefit to the United States.
Now, Marco Rubio is extremely influential in the current U.S. regime. He's the second most powerful official after Donald Trump. He's much more powerful than Vice President J.D. Vance, because Rubio is not only the Secretary of State, the head of U.S. foreign policy, he's simultaneously acting as the U.S. National Security Advisor, that is the head of the National Security Council. Rubio is only the second person in U.S. history to simultaneously hold both positions after the notorious war criminal Henry Kissinger, who fulfilled both positions under Richard Nixon. But it's not just that. Marco Rubio is also the acting chief of USAID, the so-called U.S. Agency for International Development. So Rubio has been given extreme power to oversee U.S. foreign policy. And Rubio is a lifelong extreme neoconservative war hawk who has obediently supported every single U.S. war of aggression, and he is especially obsessed with overthrowing the revolutionary Cuban government. This is a lifelong personal obsession for him. He is the children of wealthy right-wing Cuban immigrants who voluntarily moved to Florida, although he has lied about it. Earlier in his career, he claimed for a long time that his parents were supposed refugees of communism who supposedly fled Fidel Castro, which was a total lie. His parents were very wealthy and they voluntarily moved to Florida before the victory of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. And the community that Rubio is from in Miami, Florida, is the heart of the far-right corrupt Cuban oligarchs, the elites, some of whom were slave owners and big landlords, and they worked with the mafia, and they moved to Miami, Florida, and previously they worked closely with the corrupt right-wing dictator of Cuba, Fulgencio Batista, who is a U.S. puppet who ruled Cuba with an iron fist, with a brutal dictatorship, and he had a very close relationship with the mafia. And Rubio is linked to some of these crime networks in Miami, Florida. By the way, Rubio lived with his brother-in-law, who was a prolific cocaine trafficker, a drug lord, who was imprisoned for trafficking drugs. And then after Rubio's drug trafficking brother-in-law was released from prison, Rubio used his political position to lobby for his brother-in-law to get a real estate license, which is very difficult for convicted felons and narco traffickers. And this earned Marco Rubio the nickname Narco Rubio. And Rubio has also earned that nickname because he's very close to corrupt right-wing drug trafficking politicians across Latin America, including, for instance, Rubio is a close ally of Alvaro Uribe, the corrupt former president of Colombia. And U.S. intelligence agencies have admitted that Uribe is one of the worst Colombian drug traffickers in modern history, who worked very closely with the Medellin cartel and Pablo Escobar. And not just that, Marco Rubio is also a close political ally of the right-wing former dictator of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernández. And in fact, Rubio was one of the people who convinced Donald Trump to pardon this convicted drug dealer, one of the worst drug traffickers in modern history, Hernández, who was released from a U.S. prison because Trump freed him. So Narco Rubio is overseeing U.S. foreign policy, and he and the Miami Mafia are desperate to get control of Cuba once again so they can exploit the country and turn it into a new Epstein Island for U.S. elites. They've been trying to do this for decades, and they think that now, with Donald Trump in the White House, this is the perfect opportunity. This has obviously been one of Rubio's top priorities. In fact, on the 31st of January, just 11 days after the new Trump administration entered office in 2025, the Rubio State Department published a press statement announcing that it was restoring a tough U.S.-Cuba policy, setting the stage for this medieval siege. And then in June 2025, the Trump White House boasted that it was strengthening the policy of the U.S. toward Cuba, which is a euphemism, saying that they're trying to suffocate Cuba by banning companies from doing financial transactions. And this is not only U.S. companies, but foreign companies, because the U.S. threatens secondary sanctions on foreign companies that do business with Cuba. They also reaffirmed the ban on tourism and the economic embargo, which was later escalated into a full-on siege. And then in January 2026, the Trump administration published an executive order declaring the government of Cuba a, quote, unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States, which is completely crazy. As if Cuba were going to attack the U.S. or something. It's complete nonsense. But what was the excuse given by the Trump White House? They complained about Cuba's close relations with Russia, the People's Republic of China, Iran, and also Hamas and Hezbollah, which again is completely absurd. But they made it clear that what they're really concerned about is that Cuba continues to build deep intelligence and defense cooperation with the People's Republic of China. So once again, China, 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 China. And the Trump administration has brought back the 200-year-old colonial Monroe Doctrine from back in 1823, the colonial era, in which the U.S. Empire declares that it controls all of the Americas and that Latin America is part of the U.S. imperial so-called sphere of influence, or the U.S. Empire's so-called backyard. And the Trump administration has proudly dubbed this the Monroe Doctrine. And they have threatened all of the countries in the Western Hemisphere and at gunpoint forced them to break off all ties to China and Russia and Iran. And instead, to allow U.S. corporations to exploit all of the natural resources and all of the geostrategic infrastructure in the region, treating it all like a big U.S. colony. So now the question is, will other countries challenge the U.S. empire that is trying to suffocate this small island nation? And we've seen reports that Russia is going to challenge the U.S. blockade, and Russia has said it's going to supply Cuba with oil as humanitarian aid. And Trump has threatened to impose tariffs on Russia in response, but the Russian government has responded saying, fine, impose tariffs on us. We have very little trade with the U.S. anyway, So Russia is willing to call the U.S. bluff because it's not really going to do much damage to the Russian economy. However, the question that many people have is, if Russia does send oil to Cuba, will the U.S. military just seize the oil tanker and steal the oil? Because the Trump administration has already done this multiple times with oil tankers carrying Venezuela oil. In fact, this February, the U.S. regime illegally seized an oil tanker carrying Venezuelan crude in the Indian Ocean on the other side of the planet. And of course, this is not the first time. The Trump administration has done this multiple times. The U.S. military has illegally seized multiple tankers carrying Venezuelan oil. And then Trump insisted that the U.S. regime is going to steal that oil and steal those tankers.
Speaking of Venezuela, oil, what are we going to do with the oil that we have?
Going to do with what?
The oil that has been seized. The United States seized 1.9 million barrels of oil on December 10th.
We're going to keep it.
Where's it going? Are we going to sell it or put it in the strategic oil
reserve? Maybe we'll sell it. Maybe we'll keep it. Maybe we'll use it in the strategic reserves. We're keeping it. We're keeping the ships also.
So even if Russia does send oil to Cuba, it's not clear if Russia could actually succeed in getting that crude to Cuba. Obviously, Russia is quite far away, way over in Eurasia. And the U.S. military is carrying out a medieval blockade of Cuba right now. Meanwhile, China has also publicly come out and supported Cuba. Beijing has harshly criticized the illegal U.S. siege of Cuba. And China said it's going to do what it can to support Cuba. One of the biggest ways that China has been helping is that China has provided Cuba with a lot of solar panels, helping to build out solar farms, because that's honestly the best medium to long-term solution for Cuba, for energy sovereignty, to have its own energy supply locally from the sun, so it's not reliant on importing oil, although Cuba would still need oil for gasoline for cars and other vehicles. The spokesperson of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs called for the immediate lifting of the U.S. blockade and sanctions and said it will continue to support and assist Cuba, and said they believe the Cuban people will tide over the difficulty. But Cuba really needs oil. That's the most important thing in this moment, is Cuba needs oil in the short term. China has provided medium to long-term solutions, but they need oil, and Russia's the only country thus far that has said that it's willing to challenge the U.S. tariffs and sanctions because there is so little trade between the U.S. and Russia. The situation with China is obviously very different. China is still the third most important trading partner of the U.S., and the U.S. is a very important trading partner for China. So if the U.S. put more tariffs on China and started the trade war again, this would cause another crisis. Trump already started a trade war against China in April of 2025. And at this moment, Beijing is trying to reduce tensions, not raise them. So it's a very complicated geopolitical moment. There's also a question about whether or not other countries in Latin America will support Cuba. Brazil is talking about maybe sending aid to Cuba, although Brazil has an election coming up in October, and Lula da Silva is focusing more on the election. And Trump already threatened 50% tariffs on Brazil in 2025. So Brazil in this moment is really trying to reduce tensions, and they're afraid of the economic backlash from the U.S. that could hurt the Brazilian economy significantly in an election year. And then there's also Mexico, which is a major producer of oil, but Mexico has not been sending oil to Cuba because Mexico is also very afraid of the U.S. attacking it. Again, the U.S. is the main culprit here, and a lot of people are understandably criticizing Mexico, Brazil, and China for not sending oil, but the U.S. is threatening them too. It's not just threatening Cuba. The U.S. is saying that it's going to impose tariffs and sanctions on any country that trades with Cuba and gives oil to Cuba. And especially for a country like Mexico, this would be devastating because 80% of Mexico's exports go to the United States. 80%. That is such an extreme level of economic dependency. And Trump is now weaponizing that dependency. He's threatening Mexico and saying, if you help Cuba, we will crush your economy. And I should add that Latin American leaders are also afraid after the U.S. military invaded Venezuela in January and kidnapped Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. So other left-wing Latin American leaders are afraid they could be the next one to be assassinated or kidnapped by this crazy U.S. rogue regime. And of course, this is part of the larger strategy to collapse Cuba, because previously Venezuela was providing a lot of oil to Cuba, and now Venezuela is no longer able to export oil to Cuba because the U.S. is controlling Venezuela's oil. This is the crazy imperialist policy being carried out by this bloodthirsty rogue regime in Washington that thinks it controls the entire world. And speaking of the world, I need to emphasize that almost every country on earth opposes the illegal U.S. blockade of Cuba. Every single year at the United Nations General Assembly, there is a vote calling for an end to the illegal U.S. embargo. And every single year, almost every country on earth votes to condemn the illegal blockade and call for it to end. In 2023, the vote was 187 to just two countries. In 2024, again, it was 187 countries against two. The only two countries on earth that have consistently voted in support of the blockade are the U.S. itself and Israel, the apartheid state in Israel. In 2025, the Trump administration, and especially Marco Rubio, lobbied and blackmailed and pressured countries all around the world to vote with them against the UN. They could only get six other countries to join the U.S. in voting in support of the blockade. Those countries were the U.S., Israel, Argentina, Hungary, Paraguay, North Macedonia, and Ukraine, the NATO puppet regime in Ukraine. And this is after Marco Rubio did everything he could to try to force other countries to vote with the U.S. So this demonstrates how the U.S. Empire's cruel and barbaric policy against Cuba is not supported by the vast majority of the international community. But again, there are no consequences for the U.S. Empire, because the U.S. has veto power in the U.N. Security Council, and the U.S. rogue regime threatens to impose sanctions and tariffs on any foreign country or foreign company that dares to do business with Cuba. Because if a foreign company does business with Cuba, then they risk secondary sanctions, which means they have to choose. They can either do business in the U.S., which is one of the world's largest markets. It is the second biggest economy on earth when you measure its GDP at purchasing power parity. It has 350 million people. So why would foreign countries and foreign companies sacrifice that and risk being sanctioned in the U.S.-controlled international financial system, which is based on the dollar? Why would they sacrifice that to trade with a small island country with just 11 million people? It doesn't make sense for them. This is why the U.S. blockade against Cuba is so devastating, because it's not just about preventing Cuba from doing business with the U.S. It prevents Cuba from doing business with most of the world, and it blocks Cuba from accessing the U.S.-controlled so-called international financial system, which is not really international. It's still largely dominated by the U.S. Moreover, the Cuban-American journalist Arturo Dominguez pointed out that since 2019, Cuba has been unable to purchase anything that has 10% of U.S. parts in it after Trump's so-called maximum pressure sanction policy in his first term lowered that previous threshold from 25%. So even before Trump became president the first time, Cuba was not able to buy any products that had parts 25% of which were made by U.S. companies, which is many electronics goods. He pointed out this means that any foreign-made product today containing more than 10% U.S. parts or technology, so, you know, think about all of the U.S. big tech corporations like Apple and Microsoft, any of those technologies, any of those products require a U.S. government license to be sold to Cuba, which is always denied under the U.S. embargo policy. Even during the pandemic, not only Trump, but also the Biden administration cited this. This is bipartisan. It's totally barbaric. Arturo Dominguez pointed out that this is the main reason why Cuba struggles to purchase medical equipment, equipment for its power grid, which it needs to maintain the electrical infrastructure, even if it has oil, which it doesn't currently have because of the barbaric U.S. blockade. So foreign critics love to say that Cuba's problems stem from economic mismanagement. But when a country has to navigate sanctions like this, it's not really about mismanagement. It's not really about corruption. This is a barbaric blockade that has been going on for decades, but Trump and Marco Rubio have taken it to a whole new extreme level to starve as many Cubans as possible. As the Cuban-American journalist Arturo Dominguez wrote, they'll tell you Cuba is a failed state, but Cuba often outperforms its much wealthier neighbors. Cuba's infant mortality rate and life expectancy are often equal to or better than those in the U.S., and they're better than most of the countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, even countries that are much wealthier than Cuba and not under these suffocating sanctions. Since its literacy campaign in 1961, just 2 years after the Cuban Revolution, Cuba has maintained one of the highest literacy rates on Earth at nearly 100%. Moreover, Cuba sends doctors all around the world to help people in poor countries, and Cuba has manufactured its own vaccines and led innovation in medicine. In Cuba, everyone has a right to housing, food, free healthcare, free education. Those are all fundamental human rights. Imagine how much better Cubans would be without a 60-year illegal blockade and sanctions that have cost Cuba trillions of dollars and led to many deaths in Cuba. Arturo Dominguez wrote this. He's a Cuban American. There are many other Cuban Americans who have the same view. They oppose the U.S. regime's attempt to starve their countrymen, their family members. But the voices of those Cubans are silenced in the mainstream corporate media. Instead, the mainstream corporate media, largely based in Miami, Florida, interviews these far-right extremists in the U.S. Congress, like the representative Carlos Jimenez, also from Miami, Florida, who's posting photos online of far-right extremists in Cuba wearing Make Cuba Great Again hats, who are calling on Trump to invade their country, just like the far-right extremist Venezuelans from the rich elites, the oligarchs, who called in Venezuela to invade their country. This far-right extremist congressman, Carlos Jimenez, has been posting on Twitter calling for no oil, no travel, no oxygen. That's the slogan that he and the Miami Mafia are using to call for terrorizing the people of Cuba, to starve the people of Cuba, to deny them electricity, and to deny them oxygen. They're literally calling for suffocating, asphyxiating the Cuban people. And what is their end game in all of this? What exactly is their goal? Well, the congressman Carlos Jimenez, the representative of the Miami Mafia, he let the cat out of the bag. He said the quiet part loud, and he admitted that the goal is for U.S. corporations to colonize Cuba. He posted an insane image showing a map of Cuba colonized by U.S. corporations like McDonald's and Walmart and Airbnb and Tesla, and then luxury brands like Tiffany and Rolex and Gucci. This is the vision that the U.S. empire not only has for Cuba, this is the vision that the U.S. empire has for planet Earth, for every country, every inch of the planet. They want it all to be colonized by U.S. corporations and controlled by billionaire oligarchs like Elon Musk, like Jeff Bezos, like Mark Zuckerberg, who fund U.S. politicians, who buy off U.S. politicians, who determine what U.S. government policy will be. This is their plan for all of the planet. And they want to destroy any country that challenges the global dictatorship of U.S. corporations and big capitalist oligarchs on Wall Street and in Silicon Valley. They want to destroy any country that has an independent government that provides education and healthcare for its people, that provides public housing and invests in the people and not in the capitalist oligarchy. That is the goal of the U.S. empire. It is to exploit the entire world and turn the entire world into the property of U.S. corporations. And they're openly saying it. And they're willing to starve millions of innocent people and women and children to bring about that goal. They have said it so obviously, they're not even hiding it. This is not necessarily new with Donald Trump, but Trump has taken the veil off. He's removed the mask and shown the true face of the barbaric U.S. empire. On that note, I'm going to conclude. I am Ben Norton. I'm the editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. I want to thank everyone for joining me today. Please like and subscribe. Please share this. I will see you all next time.
Fidel and Che Guevara lay in a ship at anchor in the harbor, waiting for the evening tide to rise and bring high water. It's bound for Cuba, she must go across the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Ocean. She's carrying a human cargo, 83 good compañeros, each one burning with determination to be free. Against Batista, the Fidelista, courage was their armor as they fought at Fidel's side with Che Guevara. 10 days out from Mexico, these compañeros landed on the Cuban beach, Los Colorados. Fidel said, this year we'll see our country and our people free, or else we will be martyred. We've only guns enough for 20, the enemy has arms aplenty, need a man to feed him, he'll keep us well supplied. Against Batista, the Fidelista, courage was their armor as they fought at Fidel's side with Che Guevara. 5 weeks later in the Canyon del Rio, the Fidel's army had been reduced to 18 compañeros. Hungry, weak and unafraid, learning revolution's trade in the high Sierra Maestra, where the mountain winds did blow, bearing seeds to sprout and sow, crops in Cuban soil that marked the death of slavery. On compañeros to El Avero, courage was their armor as they fought at Fidel's side with Che Guevara. They fought their way across the peak of El Turquino, joined by bands of volunteers and the men from Santiago. They faced Batista's tanks and trains, drove them back down to the plains from the high Sierra Maestra. They drove the gangsters from Las Villas straight across the Cordilleras. Santa Barbara fell to Che Guevara and was free. On compañeros to El Avero, courage was their armor as they fought at Fidel's side with Che Guevara. The fire lit on that Cuban beach by Fidel Castro still shines all the way to Terra del Fuego. Sparks are blown upon the breeze, people rise from off their knees when they see the night is burning. It blazes up in Venezuela, Bolivia, Guatemala lights the road that we must go in order to be free. And compañeros, Americanos, courage was their armor as they fought at Fidel's side with Che Guevara. Courage was their armor as they fought at Fidel's side with Che Guevara.